I'd give Benham Brown my bone marrow.
I would give Rashad Anderson my bone marrow. Hell, I would not give Benham Brown my bone marrow.
Okay. What about like Niels Gafai?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
I'm telling you, I'm loose with the bone marrow. I'm not sure you can name a player I won't give bone marrow to.
Nick Forrestowski.
Yeah, he can have some.
Doug Wren.
Bro, who are you talking to? Stoddard. I will bust Doug Wren out of prison to give him my bone marrow. Is he still in prison?
How about Ed Nelson?
Fuck yeah. You know what the doctor would say right before we put the bone marrow needle in? Baby, you about to get stuck. Hey everybody, welcome to the Dime Bat Podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tyler Wilkinson. We're joined today by our staff writers. We have Megan Bard.
Hello.
And Peter Bard.
Yo.
And Russ Steinberg.
Hello.
Our podcast producer, Alex Cohen, has decided he hates all of us. Just across
especially
the board
you.
And just doesn't want to be around us for at least like a week. So until then, we'll see him later. So we should say, so we're recording this on Monday night, and literally as we hit record, news just broke that UConn has hired a new athletic director, and it's Auburn COO David Benedict, who I had never heard of before about 15 minutes ago. So I don't know. Anyone have quick fire thoughts?
I'm most surprised that it's someone we haven't heard of. That's the thing, that like there were so many names out there. Like there were a lot of names out there, and this wasn't one of them. So that I think is the strangest part about it.
But we did hear it was going to be someone kind of unconventional, though, didn't we, Peter?
Yeah, actually, I'd heard a rumor a while ago that it was going to be someone from, quote, the business side.
Pulling a name out of Auburn's sort of front office is a very, very clear signal that UConn wants to be known as caring a lot about their football program now. And that's really the takeaway I take from it. And Auburn is a gigantic athletic department that runs a gigantic football program. And he's basically been running the day-to-day operations of that, it sounds like. So I think the rationale for it is probably pretty clear, at least.
You have to think he must have wowed him, though. Like, I mean, even the guy who we saw, a Jersey guy who's apparently had some, like, perhaps inside info, I don't really know, but he wasn't on that list either, and he must have really wowed him if he was somebody who was sort of below the radar and maybe, as you said, from the business side.
What would be the advantage to taking someone from the business side?
UConn needs a lot of money.
Oh, that's true.
And you want someone who's going to raise a lot of money.
I would hope they aren't thinking that short term, though. I mean, that's important, obviously, but I would hope that there's a broader perspective.
I think they're stacking the deck for the Big 12.
I would have expected them to get someone with a Power 5 connection in a conference we had a chance of getting in. Like, I mean, I understand Auburn, but it's like, that's not the Big 12. That's not the Big 10. Like, I don't know. It just, I'm not sure. Is that the right connection you want to be making it? I mean, who knows? It's sort of hard to say at this point.
It's interesting. So also right as this broke, so the Huskies apparently ran a full-page advertisement in the Dallas Morning News, basically extolling their greatness in the state of Texas. It says, "This ain't our first rodeo," in giant script, and then it says, "UConn's excited to be back in Texas, where we wrote the most recent chapter in our championship legacy." And then pictures of a bunch of trophies, and I don't know, it seems pretty clear what they're up to.
What up, Texas? UConn in the house.
All right, man. I guess we'll move on. That's just that threw us through a loop right now. We'll have more on this, obviously, and UConn's going to do a introductory press conference. So we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. So UConn lost again on Sunday in another sort of painstaking fashion, this time against Houston. And I don't know, it's been there as sort of the modus operandi of the season, right? They play decent one game and then can't sustain it, and they can't hold leads, and they disappear for long stretches of a time, and this time it caught him again. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think this was about as deflating a loss as we've seen this season. It was, first of all, it was a home game against a team that you already beat on the road. Secondly, you know you have SMU coming up this week, which made this game so much bigger, knowing that losing back-to-back this time of year could be potentially devastating. And then you go and you look at the game itself. UConn had a 9-point lead in the first half. We were feeling pretty good about things and just couldn't get a stop. I mean, everyone's taken note of this already. Houston was running pretty much at will. UConn couldn't stop them in transition and didn't have one consistent answer to any run. I don't think UConn scored more than 4 straight points at all in the second half.
They did not.
I think the particularly frustrating part of this is going into the season, we looked at this roster, we said it's so balanced, they're not going to have cold shooting nights because it would require 3, 4, 5 guys to be shooting poorly all at once. But then that has happened.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, last night, how we win that game if either Gibbs or Purvis wasn't ice cold.
Yes.
I mean, yep. Those guys, how many open looks from three did they get in the second half? And they're not even come close. You know, if we're creating open 3-point shots and getting the ball to our best 3-point shooters and they're just missing them, what are you going to do? That's not a coaching failure. That is an execution failure.
People will disagree with you on that.
I mean, there was failures all over that game. Letting Houston shoot 60% in the second half is insane.
Crazy.
That,
but again, that's the thing that happens when we stop making shots is it makes it easier for the other team to get on transition. When we talk, we've been talking about this for years. These teams don't function on defense if they can't hit shots on offense.
Yep.
Because it makes it too easy for the other team to run against them. You need to be able to set up in the half court on defense, and then you go down and you make your baskets, and then you can defend again. But if you're constantly chasing them, you're never going to be in that position.
We also saw what I feel like has been sort of a pattern this year where Sean Miller gets a couple really easy or good looks in the post at the very beginning of the game, usually with success. I think he made his first 2 shots, and then he didn't attempt another for the entirety of the first half, and I think he went like 2 for 4 in the second half, and he gets in foul trouble.
Well, how much that 'cause he was out. Yeah.
A lot, but when Gibbs and Purvis are going like 0 for 9 from 3, you can't have 2 free throw attempts in the second half. And you can't give up on arguably your best offensive option, which is Miller. So, yeah. I mean, at some point, like, I get that expecting your 2 best shooters to miss every shot they take is probably, you're probably pretty safe assuming that won't happen most of the time. But we've seen this team fail to adjust when things are going poorly for them all year long, and this was just the latest example.
Yeah, and I think that's the part that you could pin on coaching. Not, you know, missed layups or the other team shooting 60%, but it's a failure to make an adjustment when things aren't going your way, as you said.
They've been one of the best defensive teams in the country all year. I don't think his defense magic pixie dust wore off. Obviously, there was some other issue there, and I don't know that there's an in-game adjustment to fix that on the fly, because I don't know what the problem was. I don't know why they suddenly couldn't keep up in transition other than the fact that Houston was getting a lot of defensive rebounds because we were missing a lot of shots in the second half.
Because UConn has no heart, no focus, and no leadership. That's a direct quote, I think, to Kevin Ollie.
Well, I probably wouldn't call out the team, the leadership of the team I'm coaching, but
there were some instances, Tyler, you were at the games, maybe you could tell us, where Steve Lapis pointed out that UConn just wasn't hustling back on defense. Were you able to see that?
Yes. Basically, the couple instances it was really obvious is when UConn looked like they were going to have their own fast break attempt, and then some sort of a turnover happened, and the guys that had sort of run out ahead just quit on the play. It happened once with Gibbs. I think it happened once with Purvis. What was actually, I mean, that was really annoying, but was more troubling sort of to me was when plays would dissolve on both ends of the floor, they were really getting at each other. Hamilton was yelling at Brima, Purvis is yelling at Brima, Gibbs is yelling at Purvis. You know, as you're watching sort of this dysfunctional performance on the court, they looked really dysfunctional interacting with each other, which individually they're such, you know, they're really nice guys. And I know we sort of like to hedge against the chemistry argument, but I don't know. I left that game feeling like these guys don't particularly seem to enjoy playing with each other that much. And I was left wondering how much that might be affecting their performance.
Or the other way around.
Sure.
They're playing like crap, and so they don't like playing with each other very much right now. I guarantee you, they loved playing with each other against South Florida.
Yeah, they were having a good time in the last game.
But I think this boils down to something we've talked about a lot and something we were actually really concerned about coming into the season, which I feel like has manifested itself, is that sort of without the defined roles that you would expect to find at this point in the season, guys are still kind of struggling to find their spots game to game. I think it's part of what's leading to a lot of the inconsistencies. I know, Peter, you mentioned this at one point, that without that one guy on the court who you know his job is to stop the opposing team's run. Not having this guy on the roster is very obvious and very problematic.
I think the teams do better when the guys have clearly defined roles. I mean, I've talked about this before. I think that the 98-99 UConn team had the best chemistry I've ever seen because everybody knew what their job was. And you had one guy whose only real skill was scoring a lot of points. Hamilton was not a particularly well-rounded player, but he was an incredible volume scorer. And so whenever they needed a basket, that's where they went. And as a result, other teams couldn't go on these big runs because he'd be able to get those points back, and you slow down the momentum and you make them set the ball from the backcourt. They can't just go out and run after you score a basket. So when we get with a team like this where it's, you know, Gibbs has got the ball with 15 seconds on the clock and nobody seems to really know what anyone's supposed to do. Like, you know, he's going to sort of try and create his own shot, but or maybe he gives it to Hamilton and Hamilton tries to penetrate, or maybe Purvis tries to do this or whatever. And I think it's disjointed because of that. I think that they haven't been able to figure out what is my job going to be out here and who's the guy I'm supposed to get the ball to in situations X, Y, and Z. And if that may be the biggest coaching failure, that they don't understand or they don't know or they haven't been trained on what their dynamic is supposed to be.
Well, it's not even sure like that Ollie knows. I mean, the lineups have been kind of puzzling. There's been so many different iterations of the lineup, and I don't know that anybody has any clue what anyone's supposed to be doing. And it's hard to have any kind of offense when you're not getting any kind of real instruction or there's any kind of fluidity. And I mean, part of teams having a lot of chemistry is they play together for a long time. Like that 99 team, like those guys have been playing together for a bunch of years. You got a bunch of guys who've been playing together essentially for a year in a lot of cases that nobody knows what anybody else is going to do. They just don't really know each other well enough yet. And maybe that's why you're seeing the same kind of like bickering and super hard to work like that.
You know, over the last few games, I think fans have really gotten on Sterling Gibbs a lot, particularly after this Houston game, just because he was ice cold. And I'm wondering how much people expected him to kind of be that leader or that scorer just because of what they saw from him at Seton Hall that just hasn't, for whatever reason, translated here at UConn. And if that's really fair to have put that expectation on him.
I put that expectation on him. I thought he would be the team's leading scorer. I thought he would be a little bit more well-rounded than he's shown. He's not been
Why did you think he'd be the team's leading scorer?
I thought that his particular skill set fit well with this roster, and that playing with a more sort of professional organization and a more structured program would benefit him greatly, since it seemed like that was something he might have been missing throughout his college career. I will say I didn't think he would score 20 points a game, but I thought there would be probably four guys in double figures and he would be around 14 points a game. It's hard with a shooter to weather those sort of ups and downs, but I was expecting more consistency from him, especially if his shots wasn't falling. I was just sort of expecting him to be able to be a little bit more creative and finding other ways to score.
Well, that whole finishing around the rim thing seems to have been a problem all season for him and others as well.
Most of the team, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like that's been a real issue. I mean, even with like Raid and Shabazz, who were smaller guys, like they definitely finished around the rim more.
Well, Bogut did,
but and if they didn't, they went to the foul line, yeah. Which is deemed as too easy.
That's the other thing is Napier wasn't great at finishing around the rim, but he created a ton of contact.
Or even Kemba, like it's just, I mean, you did have those guys who could get all the way to the rim and make the bucket, and it doesn't seem like anybody's really capable of just getting inside and doing some circus shit and getting to the foul line. And you would hope that Gibbs would, because he's such a strong free throw shooter. And I don't know why that isn't a better tool for him, why he isn't able to create as much contact as he can and get to the free throw line. Because that's, you know, most of the time, that's going to be 2 points right there.
He actually
has the highest free throw attempt rate of all of our guards, of all of our perimeter players, really.
He also has the lowest 2-point field goal percentage of anyone on the roster except Sam Cassell Jr.
Yeah, that's really, that's brutal.
Who is this? Who's above, right above him?
Hamilton.
Oof.
I know.
There you go. Those are supposed to be like our two of our key ball control guys, and neither of them can score. inside the three-point arc.
And neither are getting to the free throw line at all, or at least relative to what they should. I mean, Hamilton, how many free throws has Hamilton even attempted this season? I feel like Hamilton never gets to the line except in the last 10 seconds of a game.
Attempt rate is about 21%. Gibbs is almost 40.
Who's the worst regular? Adams?
Worst regular, yeah, Adams is at but just below Hamilton. Adams is at 19 and change.
So again, we have like two of our highest usage players. Two of them can't score inside, and two of them can't get to the foul line.
I will say Adams does appear to be able to finish around the rim. He's gotten some real nice moves in the lane. Is that your thing going on? Nice.
Over the last couple of weeks, he's been probably the best offensive weapon they have. I think Miller's probably their best offensive player, but Adams is the one doing the bulk of the creating on offense.
Yeah, Adams getting a little bit more aggressive on offense, which has been nice to see, because you've got to think that's what we've been transitioning to, is getting him to be the guy that's going to be the guy.
Yeah, he definitely looks a lot more comfortable out there now than he did, you know, in December.
I really like seeing him actually make the move to the bucket, because it does feel like that's sort of the thing that's been missing this season, is somebody who's really going to get into the lane and penetrate, which is something you want if you're going to have these three-point shooters. You got to get him open.
I guess maybe we should transition to sort of their tournament prospects at the moment.
Playoffs?
Well, because here's the thing. So they have SMU next, then Senior Day they host UCF, and then they're going to play fucking probably Tulsa or
Houston, I think.
Yeah, Tulsa or Houston in the first round of the AAC tournament. And they have just looked really incapable of stringing together two well-played games in a row this year. And to wit, they are 7-9 versus the KenPom Top 100 this year. And I think that includes exactly one stretch of consecutive wins, which was that Tulsa SMU earlier this month. So, I mean, clearly we think they're, barring a disaster, they're in the tournament right now. But I am very unconfident in their ability to win two consecutive games, either in the AAC tournament or come the NCAA tournament.
I don't disagree with you. It doesn't seem like at this point in the season they've really got it figured out to any degree. I mean, when they play crappy teams, they beat them, but I don't know. I don't know if they're going to be able to play with any consistency against teams that are better than they are or even close to as good as they are. I don't know how that works out.
Yeah, and I think that there are instances, particularly, you know, in a conference tournament, if you have to play three games in as many days against the better teams in the conference, it seems like every time UConn faces the slightest bit of adversity, it snowballs so quickly, and I don't know if UConn will be able to respond to that at all, because they haven't shown they could, but especially in a tournament setting against a team like Temple that's already gotten them twice, or Cincinnati who they could face again. I think that's pretty concerning, and it goes back to not having that defined run-stopping leader that that Peter talked about a few minutes ago.
So, Russ, you just did your bracket for our email newsletter, and where'd you have UConn?
I had him as a 10 seed in Xavier's pod. So 10 seed going to St. Louis, playing St. Joe's in the first round.
So let's run some hypotheticals here.
All right.
So let's say they lose to SMU. Let's say they beat UCF and they lose the opening game of the AAC tournament against Houston or Tulsa. Are they in?
21-11.
Yeah. And if that's what happens, UConn should be very nervous. Because I'm not going to say they're definitely out. I think it depends on what else happens in the bubble, how many teams win their conference tournaments that wouldn't have otherwise gotten in, you know, from multi-bid leagues, stuff like that. But I would not be confident at all, because you look at the end of the season and it would include probably two losses to Houston, or a loss to Houston and a loss to Tulsa. Those two teams will be bubble teams, so that's going to help them. So UConn might be bolstering someone else's resume and hurting their own at the same time. Plus, you're losing to SMU, which is a huge opportunity for another quality win. And I don't think people look at UConn's resume right now and see enough big-time wins there. They have at Texas, which looks great, and home against SMU. I don't know how people feel about Michigan right now. They've kind of faltered lately. Ohio State's not bad, but they're still, you know, not great, and that was a home game. They do need one more really good win to kind of solidify their standing and finishing with, you know, by beating UCF and losing those two other games. I don't think that's going to do it.
So to flip that hypothetical, you think if they win either at SMU mm-hmm. or at least one game in the tournament?
If they beat SMU and then lose their first game in the American tournament, I think they're probably just because that SMU win would be so strong. And whoever they play in the first round of the American tournament, it's not going to be a bad team. It's not going to be a bad loss. Just more of a missed opportunity. But then again, beating somebody in the first round of the American tournament, it's not going to be something that really catches the committee's attention either.
Right.
So I think if UConn loses at SMU, I wouldn't feel really confident unless they win two games in the American tournament, make it to the championship game.
So basically, they should probably just beat SMU.
That would make things a lot easier.
That would make things better.
Or I mean, they could just win the tournament. That'd be cool too. Just
yeah,
or both.
They could lose these last two games and win the tournament, and just it's not going to make a difference.
Nice 5-game winning streak would be like really nice heading into the NCAA tournament.
That'd be super.
That would be great.
Let's just make us all wrong. Suddenly, they just start playing the best basketball of their season. Rattle off 5 wins. Everything's great.
So if you liked this episode of Russetology, you can get more every week in the A Dime Blast, our weekly-ish UConn email newsletter that you can sign up for. Go to adimeback.com, and then under the More menu option, it's like the first option. Sign up, send you an email, has some cool shit in it. Peter does a top 25 poll. Megan answers a mailbag question. We give you some sweet links. Usually there's a funny picture. All good shit.
We give someone a shout-out, too.
Yeah, especially if it's your birthday, man. You got it made. Imagine how many followers these guys are getting. Oof.
Oh, I know.
Oof. So many.
We're star builders, man. Hop on our brand. Speaking of mailbag, you want to do an instant mailbag?
Do it.
Yes.
Okay. Another plug. Every Friday, we answer 3 of your questions in the Adimeback mailbag. You can tweet them at us or go to that same menu and submit them online. All right. Here's what we're going to do for our mailbag question. Okay, TCF, our buddy. TCF underscore 15, our buddy Tom, asks, best off-the-court story you know about any former UConn player. Now, we discussed this a little bit beforehand, and we know a few good ones that are borderline libelous, but they're still good.
Not libelous if they're true.
Well, okay.
Also, slander, since we're saying it.
Okay.
They don't make the person in question, they don't show them in the best light, let's just say.
Sure, they're not flattering. So what we've agreed to do is tell you the story and omit the name, and then let you just guess.
I have mine already.
Tell them all.
Peter, you go first. You go first.
All right. So this doesn't exactly involve any of the behavior of the player in question. There was a player on the team when I got to college. His girlfriend, when the team was on the road, would come around and sleep with my roommate, like pretty regularly. And I remember vividly the night they won the Big East tournament my freshman year. And it was like, it would be fucked up if I called her name redacted tonight, wouldn't it? Because he had just won a Big East tournament. You can't fuck his girlfriend that night. That particular night, one of the few nights in his life, he did the right thing.
So a girl on my floor when I lived in West was rendezvousing with a certain UConn player and said that when she would go over to his room, he had pictures of his children taped up all around the bed. So whenever things were going down, she had to sit there and stare at pictures of his children.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
That's a fun one.
I will say, like, the Jersey Chaser thing, like, that's totally real. I lived on an all-girls floor, and below me lived 2 basketball players, one of whom is now very, very famous. And they had regular good times with a couple of girls down in the, and I think like roommates down at the end of my hall. And so like, you'd always see them coming upstairs, like looking for some food or some sex. And one of them did get popcorn from me one time, but just popcorn. That was it.
What's popcorn code for?
Yeah. No, it's not. It's just microwave popcorn. And
microwave popcorn.
Oh,
this is some euphemism.
No, it's not a mutual friend. And his basketball player roommate supposedly were both sleeping with some number of girls in that room.
So let's wrap up this podcast with Russ. He's going to read mean tweets and then respond to them.
All right. We're going to start with Andrea.
Hi, Andrea.
Because I love Andrea, and she's crazy.
And she's crazy.
She's very crazy. But she actually kind of accidentally brings up an interesting point. Someone had made some comment about Ali, and I responded defending him. And Andrea says, what Russ doesn't tell you is that 2010 and 2012 were played in a deep, strong league, and Ali is doing this against crap. So I was obviously referring to 2010 and 2012, which weren't very good years, but apparently that doesn't count because they were in the Big East and playing good teams. Now, the reason I wanted to respond to this was because I actually did a little bit of research today.
Holy shit.
Yeah. What? I looked at the 2010 and 2012 teams and who they lost to, and compared those losses to teams they lost to this year, using, of course, KenPom. So UConn lost yesterday to Houston, KenPom number 52. In 2012, a similar team they lost to was Tennessee at number 58. And in 2010, they lost to Michigan at 66. Temple, they lost to at 91 this year. In 2012, they lost to UCF, who was 91. In 2010 to Providence, who is 93. And I could keep going. The point is, and it's something that Porter brought up yesterday, which is that we feel worse about these losses because they're against teams named Houston and Tulsa instead of against Providence or Marquette, more familiar names, when really the quality of competition is very close in a lot of these cases. All right, so that was the first one.
Okay.
All right. This other person who was involved in this conversation says, well, Calhoun would have this team in at least the top 25. Ali is not a good coach. Hot seat time.
Hot seat time.
Hot seat. Yeah.
Another euphemism.
Sounds like it's hot take time.
So, I mean, we could talk about whether Calhoun would have this team in the top 25 or not. The thing that kind of pissed me off about this was people expecting Kevin Ali, a fourth-year head coach, to be as good as the 800-plus win legend Jim Calhoun, who was one of the greatest of all time, and how incredibly unfair that is.
I mean, you could make a credible argument that Jim Calhoun is the greatest college basketball coach ever. You could make that argument and not sound like an insane person. There's no number of years that Kevin Ollie's going to put in where I'm going to say he should be as good as Jim Calhoun by now. That's just a ludicrous bar to set for anybody.
Next one. This is from Isaac. Well, I guess the fun starts next year when the big recruiting class arrives. NIT again. Fuck you, Isaac, for giving up on the season after this loss. I would love to hear what you have to say if they beat SMU on Thursday.
I got to say, the temper tantrums that adults throw.
Aren't they
their
great?
Favorite, the things that people will say about these kids on the Boneyard immediately after a loss. I'm done with Gibbs. He shouldn't suit up for this team anymore. Like, shut up forever. Throw your computer in the garbage.
Russ, you have more mean tweets?
Yeah, one more. That's actually two more from one person.
I wish we could get the players to come on and read the tweets about themselves like they do on Jimmy Kimmel or whatever show that is.
Oh, let's try to do that after the season.
Yeah, that'd be a good goal.
All right. This is from Matt, who I actually might meet in person this week down in Florida, so I won't be too mean to him now. Because I know he's going to listen. So Matt says,
fuck you, Matt.
Shout Matt.
Talking about the 2014 championship, he says, Calhoun's players won that title. Don't tell yourself any different. And the AAC is so bad that any blue blood should win it easy. All right. So here's the thing about the Calhoun's players won that title argument. First of all, KO had been coaching them for 2 years.
And no, you see, you got to understand, Calhoun coached them so well that they were still totally saturated in Calhoun-ness.
Oh,
two years
later.
Yeah. It's like a marinade.
But now you could even say that KO had been their coach for 2 years, and they will say, but they were recruits under Calhoun.
What the fuck difference is that?
Recruiter was.
Who do you think recruited them? First of all, it was KO. And secondly, and I tweeted this this morning, a quote from Shabazz Napier during the year they were banned, 2013. saying how much of a mentor KO had been to him and how much KO had helped him improve his game.
Irrelevant.
Okay. Yeah. So, yes, Calhoun was their coach at one point, but that was as much Kevin Ollie's title as anyone else.
I mean,
the last thing he said was, if you can't win 20 regularly as UConn in the AAC, you should be fired. So UConn has already won 20 this year. They won 20 last year. They won 20 the year before that.
And they won 30 the year before.
So literally in every year the AAC has been in existence, UConn has won at least how many games? 20.
20. So there you go. So thank you, Matt, for your contribution.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for your interest in UConn athletics.
All right. Well, that was a fun episode. We're done, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I suppose that's it. It's a good way to go out on your mean tweets. Thank you for listening to the Dimebag Podcast. Don't forget, on Friday, we'll do the mailbag and sign up for some email updates. Until then, see ya.
Butts.